From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, nearly 10 years since the official end of the Great Recession, cities and towns across Michigan are still struggling to regain their financial footing.
There's some communities that are fine and doing fine, and then there's a lot of communities that aren't. And there's just too many, in my mind, too many communities that have been left behind that need assistance.
An eel farm in the works for mid-Michigan.
Based in the past, it would primarily serve domestic ethnic markets, like sushi and other Asian cuisines.
And how a Detroit chef is taking cannabis cuisine way beyond the pot brownie.
We do everything from CBD smoothies to THC vegan-friendly French dips, all kinds of delicious food.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside on this very snowy Monday. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been nearly 10 years since the official end of the Great Recession, the worst period of economic decline since the 1930s. Yet cities and towns across the state are still struggling with their finances. With a new governor and new faces in the state legislature, we wanted to see how our leaders might help local governments. Here with us is Eric Scorsone, associate professor and director of the Extension Center for Local Government Finance and Policy at Michigan State University. Eric also served as senior deputy state treasurer in the Snyder administration. Here we are, Eric, at the start of 2019. How would you characterize the financial health of Michigan cities and towns?
Well, I think certainly things are better right now than they've been in a number of years. That's not totally surprising given the strength of the economy in Michigan. So I think we can say, for the short term at least, things are better. Cities, counties are healthier. But there still remain a lot of challenges and problems that are, you know, underlying, that have been there a long time, and they haven't really gone away.
And what would those be? What do you see as the main issues that local municipalities are facing?
Well, I pick a couple. I think one, we still face a lot of restrictions on the property tax and other tax sources that continue to restrain the ability of cities and other communities to raise revenues that are adequate to what they really need, especially for infrastructure. I think, secondly, we still have the real burden of legacy costs from pension and health care systems that have been significantly underfunded for many years, that are still there and going to be an ongoing issue. Third, I mean, we talk a lot about roads and in this campaign, but most of those roads are owned by local governments, and they're still having a very hard time maintaining that infrastructure. So that remains a big risk in the long term for us.
Eric, can you give us an example of a city that just leaps to mind facing troubles because of financial stress and how it's suffering?
Yeah, sure. One would be the city of Wayne, down in what we call downriver area of Wayne County. They've lost about 45% of their tax base from the Great Recession. So if you think about losing, you know, half your revenue of any business, how tremendously difficult that would be. They have significant legacy cost burdens that are unfunded. And it's a community that's an older community, you know, has a Ford plant, but, you know, has been hurting economically. I will say community leaders have done a pretty good job trying to maintain stability under very difficult conditions, but that is a community that I would certainly put up. It's not a typical name you hear, but, you know, a good example of how our system is probably not working nearly as well as it should be.
When you say that Wayne lost 45% of its tax base during the Great Recession, here we are, how many years out of the Great Recession, and the hangover is still there?
Yeah, and that's a function of laws more than anything. I mean, I'm not exactly sure where their property values stand, but the thing is, with Proposal A from 1994, once you lose that tax base, it's very hard to get it back. It could take decades, literally. I think I estimated for some places it may be 30 years before that tax base comes back. You know, that's really difficult because, you know, other than new development, like new homes, which a place like Wayne is not getting, you're really going to take a long time to regrow the base. And then your other revenue sources, like state revenue sharing, aren't growing very fast, you know, maybe 1% or 2% a year. So it's a difficult situation for a community like that.
So what about solutions? Because here we have a new governor. We have new faces in the state legislature. What are steps that Lansing could take to help these local governments, cities like Wayne?
Yeah, I think, number one, we need to really rethink and get some more funding into revenue sharing. I think that will help a lot of communities. Statutory revenue sharing in particular needs to be funded at a better level. Now, that's not easy because the state budget has a lot of stress on it from a lot of different sources, so that has to be looked at in the mix of everything. But for a lot of these communities that are struggling, you know, raising local taxes, they've done that a lot. And the problem is their tax burdens may be very high locally to the point where they really can't do a lot more with that. And so I think the state has to help kick in more. We used to do that in the 70s with revenue sharing. We would, if you tried hard locally, then we would give you essentially more money. So I think the formula needs to be looked at. There needs to be more money put in. And the state needs to give more tools to address legacy costs. And obviously on infrastructure, road funding, the governor has obviously made a major push to think about that. So hopefully that will help the community. My other concern is locally, if you raise taxes too much, you know, do you end up getting foreclosures and things that some of the low-income households, they just can't afford these taxes or fees? And so, you know, we really want to be careful not to do too much of that either.
And so they can't raise taxes, and God knows, from the recession onward, I dare say it's safe to say costs have been cut to the bone and then some?
Absolutely. We've lost thousands of local government workers. Yes, there's been some changes in technology that help local government, but generally speaking, you need workers on the ground to do things, to plow the streets, to patrol the streets. There's just not enough. And, you know, of course, like anything, there's some communities that are fine and doing fine, and then there's a lot of communities that aren't. And there's just too many in my mind, especially when you think about some of these where there's a lot of concentrated poverty, like in a Saginaw or a Flint or even Detroit for that matter. That just exacerbates these problems for these communities. So there's just too many communities that have been left behind that need assistance. And I think I'm optimistic that this governor will start addressing these issues and putting forward plans that we really need to start thinking about.
And to that point, Eric Scarsone, you were in Rick Snyder's administration. You've been in Lansing. You've seen how policy can get waylaid by politics. What do you think it'll take to cut through the politics and come up with action that could provide relief for cities and towns?
At least initially, we've seen some good bipartisan thinking in Lansing, and I think we need to continue that way where, you know, if you can build consensus, there is a problem. And I think more and more people in the business community and other areas of the state have recognized we have a problem with how we're funding our municipalities. That is impacting public services, public health, very directly. And so I hope that in a bipartisan way, people can start to say, let's make sure we're getting more funding. If we need to have it targeted, so be it, into specific areas, because it's not just about balancing budgets. It's also about protecting public health. Obviously, we have divided government in Michigan, so
Right. It's
going to have to be bipartisan. That would be my approach, is let's get everyone on the same page that we do have issues. And we did that with the legacy cost issue when I was with the governor. We built consensus with unions and management and others. There were problems. We didn't agree on the solutions, and that's okay, but at least we all did agree there was a problem there that had to be addressed.
So it starts people down the road.
Absolutely, yeah.
What could our cities and our towns, these ones that are so financially stressed, what could they look like if these problems are left unaddressed? I guess I'm wondering, what should cause our leaders to lose sleep at night?
Great question, and I think there are some things that should keep people up at night. I mean, I think if we have more communities that end up in situations like Flint or Detroit were a few years ago, that would be very problematic for our state. Do people want to live here? Do businesses want to move here? I mean, you don't want that negative image out there of a city going under, facing bankruptcy or another infrastructure disaster. I mean, these things are all potentials right now. If you don't fund things adequately, you know, we know things can happen that are very problematic or negative. And so I would strongly say, okay, you don't have a crisis today, but it's there, and there's real issues and real risks. These are things we shouldn't want, and we should get ahead of them, and we should do it collaboratively between the state and local government. State doesn't always know everything. the state should work collaboratively with locals to say, let's get ahead of these problems, let's be proactive, and let's help give you some tools to help you address your problems, and we'll be there as a partner. Because there's just been too much animosity between the state and locals in the last 10 years, and that's just not helpful to anyone.
Eric Scorsone, who is director of the Extension Center for Local Government Finance and Policy at Michigan State University. Eric, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The snowflakes fell one by one at first. Then their numbers increased, 2 by 2, 10 by 10, then more than I could possibly count.
Ann Arbor writer Tamar Charney dropped us a postcard celebrating the very thing we Michiganders love to complain about, snow.
If I let go of the focus in my eyes, the falling snow would look like a driving torrent of snowflakes. But when I zeroed in on them, they changed form. Now they were delicate little flakes moving this way and that way as they gently drifted down past me. They also had multiple forms when they'd hit into me. First, they'd sting as the cold and the iciness of them would hit my cheek. But then just as that sensation of ever so slight pain would take hold, they'd start to melt from the warmth of my face. The cold sting became soothing as the melting caressed my cheek before evaporating. Then the next one would hit, pain followed by a caress. Snow is like that. It's beautiful and it's harsh. It makes the world white and bright, but it can make even the tiniest thing hard. Piles of snow to trudge through, roads a nightmare to drive. There are just so many ways to look at snow, so many things to feel with snow, so many ways it changes the world and everything in it. It's like no other element of weather. Wind you can feel, but you can't see. Sun casts light, but it does little to change the physical objects you encounter. Water's wet, but it's of so little substance. Snow, it hits all your senses. You can see its whiteness, and you can feel its sting and its melt. You can hear, or maybe not hear, how it muffles sound. You can be stopped by its substance, and you can slip on it too. Snow is real and tangible. And then it just melts away as quickly as it came, leaving no trace. Piles and piles can show up overnight and then be gone in a day. I've realized I feel most alive when it's winter and there's snow. These little frozen bits of water piled up around touch me in some profound way. Snow makes me feel part of something bigger, and yet at the same time, remarkably alone in a harsh, demanding world. Snow makes the outer world reflect my inner world. It constantly changes and shifts. It's lovely and terrifying. Things hurt and are soothed simultaneously. This is snow's weird beauty and its weird magic. Respond by loving or hating it. But know, the winter snowfall is something special.
Ann Arbor writer Tamar Charney is the managing director of NPR One. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A boost for the mid-Michigan economy or a potential threat to Michigan's water system? A proposed eel farm in St. John's has some worrying aloud about introducing a potentially invasive species into Michigan's inland lakes. In other words, what might happen if migratory eels escape from their possible home north of Lansing? Eric Friedman reported this story for the Capital News Service and with us now. First off, Eric, tell us about this eel, the African longfin eel.
It's a freshwater eel, and it's native to the West Indian Ocean. And it's treasured for food purposes in Asia, not so much in the United States. And it has never been successfully bred in captivity, but it's been raised on aquaculture projects in Europe and elsewhere.
So this proposed eel farm would make Michigan the first state to commercially raise this eel. So tell us about the proposal.
The facility would be located, as you said, north of Lansing in an industrial park. The proposal comes from entrepreneurs in Florida. And they say that this facility would be biosecure, so pathogens couldn't get out from the eels into the waterways and possibly have negative health effects on native species and introduced species, and the pathogens couldn't get in and infect the eels. And the operators say that the facility would be secure so that eels couldn't get out, which is the other part of becoming invasive.
What kind of economic benefits are they promising for the area if this eel farm winds up there?
Well, there would be employees at the facility, and there would be Michigan-produced fish that would go into the market, into the food stream.
So are they thinking that they're going to make eels a thing here to eat them? As you say, not so big in the U.S.
I didn't get into that with the guy who was the founder of the company, Aquavita, but based in the past, it would primarily serve domestic ethnic markets, mm-hmm. like sushi and other Asian cuisines.
So when you think of the worries that are being expressed, who's concerned and what are you hearing from them?
Well, let me tell you how the scientists decided they would look at this proposal, because in Michigan, the Department of Agriculture and Rural Development has to register or give a permit for any commercial aquaculture facility. This species has not been raised in the United States, and it's not on the list of 75 approved aquaculture species in Michigan. Mm-hmm. So the applicants would need a research permit. The Department of Ag and Rural Development, in partnership with DEQ, DNR, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, wanted to find a way to see what kind of risk, if any, allowing this operation to have. So they looked at several things. They consulted with outside experts in fish diseases and in eels, and they looked at likelihood of it escaping, therefore possibly becoming an invasive species. They looked at the possibility of pathogens, bacteria and viruses, being transferred to or from the eels. They looked at what potential impact it might have on habitat for other fish, and they looked at a few other variables. The biggest concern they felt was the possibility of pathogens, of disease, and they were not as concerned about the possibility of it actually becoming invasive. The reason, according to the founder of the company, is that if they got out, water temperatures would kill them. And if they got out, they couldn't breed. And if you can't breed, you can't become invasive.
And it's just...
So they said about the Asian carp.
Well, that's just... You took the words right out of my mouth. I mean, haven't we heard that song before? I gotta wonder, Aquavita is a Florida company. Why not just make the eel farm be in Florida? What's so attractive about mid-Michigan?
One, there's plenty of water. Two, the industrial park is located near highways. This mid-Michigan area is connected to interstate highways, so you can ship the product out. Third, there are no major rivers or waterways that run near the industrial site, so the likelihood of something getting out and then getting into one of the Great Lakes or one of the major rivers is a lot smaller than the chances would be if it were located elsewhere.
Fair enough. Like if it was somewhere along the West Michigan shoreline.
Right, near the Grand River, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
The Kalamazoo, yeah.
Now, it is a little ironic, is it not, that the head of the Michigan Aquaculture Association isn't so hot on this project? Why is that?
There might be some, I don't know. I can't speculate on that other than because he wasn't aware of the project in any detail. He hadn't seen the study. I sent him the study. But he said that the closed circulating water system that this facility would use has been difficult elsewhere to operate. And he said that, in general, experiments with other species of fish have not been commercially successful. And he gave the example of yellow perch. He said some of those, which is something that we in the Great Lakes are familiar with, that it's been difficult to get that into commercial production.
And how does the company, how does Aquavita respond to these concerns?
The company points to what it says is the success of aquaculture facilities for eels in Europe and Asia, that it's worked there so it could work here.
So what's next for this project? What would it take to make it happen? And even more to the point, what would the state do to keep an eye on things?
The project will, as I said, need a research permit from the state. It can't get the permit until the facility is constructed. The owner or the founder of the company told me that he's close to finalizing the financing of the project. What the state would do during construction is do several inspections while it's being built and consult with the company to make sure that it will be able to meet all the state requirements. When construction is complete, there'll be a final inspection. And if it passes inspection, the department can issue a research permit so it can operate.
Keeping an eye on a proposed eel farm in St. John's in mid-Michigan, seeing if this is actually going to come to fruition. Eric Friedman with the Capital News Service. Eric, thanks so much.
Good talking to you.
Stateside, I'm Cynthia Canty. Cannabis, it's not just for smoking, and there's lots more to edibles than just gummies and pot brownies. Cannabis is making its mark in kitchens, including the kitchen of Gigi Diaz of Detroit. She's been cooking professionally for years, and now she's making cannabis-infused meals for a few years now, and even winning Best Chef at the 2017 High Times Michigan Cannabis Cup. Gigi's created a business. It's called Cannabis Concepts, doing regular pop-ups all around Detroit. And with us now, Gigi, welcome.
Hi, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before we talk about how you got into cannabis cuisine, tell us just what brought you to cooking. How old were you?
Oh, my God. Well, it's been since I can remember. I come from a family of cooking. My father is a chef. My mother has been in restaurants since she was younger. So it was just something, and my grandmother, it was just something that just came to me naturally.
It's in your blood.
Yes, it is. Just born to do it.
So what kind of training did you do?
Well, actually, I grew up with my father in his restaurant. So we were in the Virgin Islands in Vieques, Puerto Rico. We had a couple different restaurants there. And so just helping him out, and then with my mother in our businesses. And that's pretty much how I got started.
So then what led you to cooking with cannabis?
Well, you know, I was always interested in different ingredients and medicinal ingredients. And always being a fan of cannabis, I always looked at it and thought about, you know, there needs to be a different way to ingest and something other than just, like you said earlier, than just pot brownies, because we want to think about people who have different dietary needs and people who are also using it to heal themselves. So that's when I started looking into more of the nutritional aspect of it and how to combine it and how to, you know, make it and refine it and perfect it.
So are we talking about cooking with cannabis with THC to get high? Are we talking about cooking with CBD oil, but for the health benefits that people can get, or both?
Well, we actually do a little bit of both. We cook with hemp, which actually, you know, you have no high. You know, we cook with CBD oils. We cook with THC as well. So, you know, again, it all depends on what the needs of the client are and what the desired effect is.
So what kinds of things do you do under this umbrella of Cannabis Concepts?
Well, we host regular pop-ups. We do different pop-ups and stuff when the Cannabis Cup comes and when other events, cannabis-related events come. We have monthly dinners. We have tastings. We also have meetings that consist of talking about different pot stocks, advice, just to people for the can of curious, things like that, just to ask questions and things of that nature. So these are some of the things we do.
Are you getting a feeling now that the proposal passed in November and suddenly it is a new world? Are you getting
I love that term you just used, kind of curious. Are you getting people that kind of were like, well, it was not legal. Now it's legal.
Yes, we are. And, you know, and that's when the information comes in. And again, when we have our tastings and stuff like that, we like to interact with the public and, you know, again, you know, talk with the kind of curious and answer some of their questions and get them to understand the different forms of consumption. And, you know, so that way they can benefit from it.
So tell us, what are some of the more popular dishes based on people's reactions at your pop-ups that you
Well,
do?
You know, when we do like the Cannabis Cup, for instance, we do our 420 taco pop-up. And we have quesadillas, tacos, burritos, more like handheld munchy items, you know. And then we also have our gourmet dinners. We have beautiful five-course dinners that consist of things like chicken cremoso, filet mignon, all of the, you know, wonderful foods you would normally eat on a very nice evening out.
And when you talk about the ways of bringing cannabis into food, what are those? What are some of the ways that people who really don't know much about it would be surprised to know that you use cannabis?
Well, I mean, you can infuse anything. Of course, you can just infuse the meal directly, but you can also use, we have coffee, sugar, salt, other components so that you can add to your meal. You can infuse your meal and you can also, you know, so that way you can work your way up. You can do it. You can get right to the point and cook with a concentrate, which would, you know, be a little bit of a stronger dosage. Or you can do something a little lighter and maybe incorporate maybe some Himalayan sea salt, something of that nature. Add a little bit to your meal and, you know, to microdose.
Now, how do you deal with how much cannabis people might be getting in the food and how it might affect them?
I mean, you know, you always got to start off low and slow.
Okay? Low and slow, yeah.
Low and slow because, you know, you don't want anybody to have a regretful experience. You know, nobody's ever died from it, but it is very uncomfortable if it's something you don't want.
If it's, okay, yes.
Right, if it's not wanted. That's why we always start anywhere between 2 to 10 milligrams, depending upon the experience, the way, you know, what the desired effect is.
And you know how to kind of calibrate that when you're cooking.
Yes, because we use all tested products that are, so that way we can go ahead and decide, like, which the dosage. Like, if let's say, for instance, if I have a syringe of RSO, Rick Simpson oil, that would contain 900 milligrams, hypothetically speaking, then I would know from then out how many milligrams I can put in each dish, how I can use it accordingly for the clients. So that way we're controlling the dosage.
Is there a taste? Does it make the food taste different?
You know, technology with doing distillate and other forms has really refined so that you don't feel like you're licking the stalk of a plant. You know, it really doesn't overpower the food. In fact, in most of the dishes, you wouldn't even know it's there. You would have no idea. So it's really come a long way since, you know, your average pot brownie. Yeah.
Thinking if even baby boomers can stop and think about back in college.
That was
the Stone Age, wasn't it? So when you do these pop-ups and people are coming to, you know, to get a nice high from the food, people Uber? I mean, how do...
Yes.
We
highly suggest that. We want people to do this responsibly, like anything. And yes, we always recommend Uber. And for patrons that come even from out of town, we always try to tell them about different hotels and recommend places where they can stay as well.
So what is legalized marijuana in Michigan going to mean for cannabis concepts?
Hopefully it's going to mean lots of great things and more expansion. You know, they're continuing to amend to this law because mm-hmm. there's different, still gray areas. There's lots of gray areas. And I think once they start to address those and maybe within another year or two, well, like right now it's recreational, but there are absolutely no stores to get recreational from.
So until a year then, from now, yeah.
Right. So until the gray area, okay, you can gift it to, like, you can grow it at your house and gift it to your friend. So that's kind of a gray area in a way because, of course, you can have it, but then where can you buy it? So I think once they get these things a little bit more settled down and the laws become even more clear than what they are right now, I think then we can really look forward to a wonderful and bright future for cannabis concepts.
And I know you're doing things at Elevated Yogi in Detroit.
Yes.
What are you doing there?
We do there after on Sunday after their yoga session, we have a wonderful luncheon that we do, and we provide vegan friendly cuisine as well. And we cover all diets: keto friendly, vegan, vegetarian, traditional. whatever you can imagine. So we do everything from CBD smoothies to THC, vegan-friendly French dips, all kinds of delicious food.
Can you see franchising this?
Yes, I can. Okay. I would love to have a restaurant group with various different restaurants. You know, like I said, we have vegan, we have traditional, so many different, concepts. And that's why we named the business Cannabis Concepts.
There you go. How can people track where you're going to be and what you're doing?
Well, you can look us up on Instagram, and that would be at HighTimes_TopCannabisChef_GG. And then you can keep up with all of our pop-ups, all of our tastings, events, all of our get-togethers. We would really love to meet more people and incorporate people here from the Ann Arbor area as well.
Gigi Diaz, the creator of Cannabis Concepts and really letting cannabis make its mark in her cuisine. Thanks for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on this wintry Michigan Monday, we'll talk with Michigan Radio's Imani Mixon, who's wrapping up a 9-month program where she embedded herself within the East Side Detroit neighborhood of Morningside.
The first thing they wanted to talk about is what the neighborhood once was, how they remember it, how they encounter it. And I really do think that it was sort of an after effect of the trauma that certain communities have with media presence, especially Black communities.
The lessons learned from engaging a community at the ground level. Coming up in about 5 minutes, you're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This month, the Michigan Supreme Court honored peacemaker Pat Wilson for his help in starting the Washtenaw County Peacemaking Court. That court opened in 2013. It's very different from any other state court here in Michigan. Here's how it works.
When the two parties who have the disagreement come together, they work out a solution that is the best solution for everyone involved. What can happen is that their relationship is renewed and recreated. Then what happens is that healing starts to develop, and it basically heals the community also.
Pat Wilson is from the Little River Band of Ottawa Indians Tribal Court, which also uses the peacemaking method. He says instead of the typical adversarial courtroom experience, people work to resolve conflicts with an eye toward rebuilding relationships. Here's how Judge Tim Connors from the Washtenaw County Peacemaking Court explained it to us back in 2014.
Let's take a young juvenile who broke into a house and took money out of somebody's purse and went off and blew the money. And the typical scenario would be, okay, you're caught, you came in, what did you do? The focus is on what the event is. All right, here's your punishment. You're the juvenile delinquent. Here's your fines and costs, and here's your punishment. And a judge like me sits up on a bench and yells at the young person and says, don't you ever do that again, and if you do, we'll really come down on you.
I don't want to see you in my courtroom one more time.
Right.
Or else.
Right.
Okay.
So in a peacemaking court, it would start off with that proposition of, okay, what happened, but then what were you thinking to the young man? What were you thinking at the time? What do you think about it now? Who do you think it affected? You need to hear from them how it affected them. If it's truly the idea, I want to make amends, then what is that proposal? And then there's the similarity that if it's done and is true, remorse and you make it up, then there has to be forgiveness on the other side.
While most cases in Washtenaw County are eligible for the peacemaking court, Judge Connor says not everyone is a good fit.
It does require the unanimous agreement of the parties to go into it. So it's a question of are their hearts in the right place? Are they really seeking peace? Or is it perhaps still a forum to act out? Not really seeking resolution, but simply trying to assert control over a situation. Obviously, it makes a great deal of sense in probate with guardianships and the distribution of property after the loved ones walked on. Who's going to take care of people who are vulnerable? It has application. We've sort of used some of those principles even in disputes between small businesses because they have ongoing relationships. Obviously, it makes a lot of sense in domestic relations where a couple, even though they are divorced, they share these children that they brought into the world, and they are going to have those situations. My great hope, though, is for the juvenile court.
The Washtenaw County Peacemaking Court is the only one of its kind in Michigan for now. But Peacemaker Wilson hopes to change that and bring the model to other parts of the state.
This is something that is that can work, and that's something that is needed. And we developed it and made it so that it works for non-Native communities.
That was Peacemaker Pat Wilson, honored this month by the Michigan Supreme Court for his work in starting the Peacemaking Court in Washtenaw County, which is still the only one of its kind in the state. And we always want to hear from you. What stories or people are you focusing on, or issues that you want to hear more about? Let us know. You can email us, stateside@michiganradio.org, and find stories you missed on Facebook. Search for Michigan Radio. We're also on Twitter, @StatesideRadio. And as always, michiganradio.org, and just click the link that says Stateside. The process of creating a news story generally goes like this. A reporter or editor pitches a story. A reporter heads out into the community, finds experts and everyday people to talk about that issue, and then write up the story for the paper, the radio broadcast, the TV news. The Morningside 48224 podcast turned that concept inside out. It provided a platform for people in the Morningside neighborhood on Detroit's east side to tell their own stories in podcast form. After 9 months of helping residents produce their own audio stories, Morningside 48224 is wrapping up, and we wanted to find out what these past 9 months have taught us. With us is Imani Mixon, Morningside 48224 podcast producer and trainer, and Jonathan J.G. Galloway, a resident of Morningside and founder of Audio Wave Network. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be here.
Yes. Thanks for having us.
So it has been a while, Imani, since we talked, and now it's time to kind of put a cap on this and talk about what you've learned. And community engagement really is a big trend within newsrooms right now. And I'm wondering, what were the surprises or obstacles that you encountered during this time of working on the podcast?
For sure. I think the last time I sat down to talk about this in the beginning of the year, it was like excitement. How do I do this? Who am I going to meet? Like, what does this look like day to day? And very quickly, I learned that the responsibilities change every day. And once you meet one person, I would say in Detroit as a whole, but definitely in Morningside specifically, you know everybody else. So I had like a little bit of time where I felt like a loner and I didn't know who was out there and what I needed to do. But as soon as I kind of got out there and started talking to people, it was just a river flowing of like, you need to know this person, that person, that person, this person. And those people really ended up being really fundamental to the process throughout. And one of those people was JG, to be quite honest. It was like a very short time between me starting and meeting him. So as soon as I started mentioning what I was working on and mentioning podcasts specifically, the first name that came up was JG.
And why was that?
And that was because he's in the neighborhood. He has a whole podcast network with about, what is it, 15 shows?
15.
Okay.
15 shows.
So, yes, let's go to JG, Audio Wave Network. Okay, tell us what kind of shows you produce.
So we started just as a bunch of friends in the basement just recording a podcast. You know, in 2015 when podcasting was still in the infancy form. Mm-hmm. So now, When I thought about getting a studio to move out of my friend's basement, like our podcast studio, it was just the river opened and everyone wanted a podcast. So I always credit what we do as giving the voice to the community. So we got podcasts based in television, religion, bar reviews, Eastside current events. So it's someone that literally reports on what's going on in neighborhoods. And, you know, we have a show for everyone, sports. It's just a home for any podcast.
It is amazing, and this year will be my 40th year in broadcasting.
Wow. That's amazing.
Which makes me sound as old as dirt. But the point I was going to make is, it is so marvelous that people can just say, "I want to do, and I want to be heard, and I have a voice." And you can do it. I mean, you started in your friend's basement. It used to be you needed to, take a third-class operator's license, and you had to get hired by a radio station, and otherwise it didn't happen. So to have this platform is that is really terrific. So did you guys collaborate at all?
We did, and I think when I started out, I was weary of, sort of like stepping on toes or assuming that something didn't already exist. So as soon as I found JG and like the larger network of people interested in media there, I was thinking about how to work in alignment instead of in opposition to what people are doing. We had that first conversation and it was like an hour long talk. It went from a meeting to being a talk, and it kind of ended with, well, what do we do now? And in that moment, we didn't have an answer, but through my time there, we were able to like collaborate on two different panels. I had you on two different panels.
Yes, definitely. So I like to hear people's ideas. So I filled every idea. But when Imani came, it just shifted because I never heard someone want to get so specific about an area, especially an area where, my studio's in. I was raised there. So it was just like, oh, this is amazing. Like, let's do it. Like, whatever you need from me, I'm there. So she's had me on two panels to discuss podcasts, help people in the community start podcasts. She sent me a bunch of referrals to, just make sure we're putting this platform out there for people. And it's just been amazing.
That is great. Mm-hmm. What was the community reaction, do you think, door to door? You were saying people started saying, yeah, you need to meet so-and-so and so-and-so. And as I think about that community reaction, you said, especially in Morningside.
Mm-hmm.
How come?
It's small. Mm-hmm. It's small.
Remind you, for people who aren't familiar.
For sure, Morningside. So it's very far east, touching Grosse Pointe, and also kind of near the Jefferson Chalmers area, I would say. So it's so small that they notice new faces, but they also welcome new faces. So I think that initial response honestly taught me about how to enter a community where it's almost like a two-level process. So there's the process of going to community events and meetings and church anniversaries or whatever
being
the thing
seen.
Is. Exactly. Visible and accessible. Mm-hmm. And then the second part is the actual work. So once we have that cool initial conversation and tell you Michigan Radio is in the neighborhood, the second part is, one, is this something you care about? Two, is this something you want to get involved in? And a lot of those initial episodes, which I think is rightful, a lot of those initial episodes, people were extremely nostalgic. The first thing they wanted to talk about is what the neighborhood once was, how they remember it, how they encounter it. And I really do think that it was sort of an after effect of the trauma that certain communities have with media presence, especially Black communities. So you want to have a good story. You want to change the dominant narrative. And a lot of that starts at home. And one of those episodes that sticks out to me, especially with a resident, Lauren Gray, who recently moved back from Hawaii as a teacher and is in Detroit living on the same street where her parents are, sort of trying to get her feet back under her. The first thing she wanted to do was travel back to find out how the neighborhood was named by one of her neighbors.
It was just the east side. Then one day, a sign appeared with the word Morningside in golden letters. And I then had a name for how the neighborhood feels to me. Beautiful, colorful, sunny.
Oh, beautiful.
Right. And she has that voice. She had a great
does.
Voice. So I was like, I kind of want you to narrate too.
Well, having this resident-led podcast, it does open up. And it's interesting that people needed to say, no, we want to show what we remember and what we knew, mm-hmm. not what you see when you watch the nightly news and some station's news truck is rolling down the street and they're doing the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested, JG, why did you feel like Morningside was the right place for the work that you do, as opposed to, let's say, downtown or the midtown spaces where a lot of media organizations have landed?
A couple of reasons. One being our studio was already close to the Morningside area when we were in the basement. We were We were technically in Morningside. And then I met this guy through a friend of mine, Orlando Bailey. He introduced me to Glenn Urquhart, and he owned a building called the Detroit Artist Test Lab. And when we met, it just felt so organic. And Glenn told me, he was like, hey, I'm a white guy in this Detroit neighborhood. I need to bring more people that are from the community into this building. And it felt like home to me. And it just, ever since then, like we're going to open our second studio location inside of Gerard's Test Lab. So it was just a connection between Orlando being from Morningside, you know, Glenn being in Morningside, and just my upbringings in the neighborhood all just kind of meshed together and said, this is where I'm supposed to be.
I'm talking with JG, Jonathan Galloway, yes, and also with Imani Mixon, who is the podcast producer of Morningside 48224, as we kind of look back over the 9 months and the 9 episodes. Imani, it struck me that you said initially people wanted to say, they wanted to get nostalgic. They wanted to go back and go, this is what it was like. And then what kinds of stories did you hear as the months progressed?
I think those first episodes were true. And it got a lot more intimate and honest in the present moment as we move forward. So I got to a point where, you know, the people who've been listening and contributing, they kind of recalled what happened. And I would say about midway through was the breaking point where I started talking to people. And not only did they want to tell a current story, but they wanted to learn every part of the process, which meant producing, recording, interviewing, taking pictures, narrating and writing that narration. So it was a much more like completely self-involved process, as opposed to, you know, we are side by side, but I'm no longer like holding your hand. I'm walking and following you to the story that you want to find. And
which was the whole point.
Literally, it just took time. So I think one thing that we have to think about with community engagement is the time it takes to build relationships and then transform that into something beautiful. And the person that comes to mind most when I think about the progression of the podcast, and he's on my mind because it's the most recent podcast, is he's a high school friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And he grew up on the east side but was living with one of his friends in West Bloomfield and attended school with me. But his grandmother has a house on the east side, and that's where he grew up. And when we reconnected, he was like, yeah, I'm trying to turn my grandma's house into a community center because she gave it up and she couldn't afford it, but I might be able to buy it back. So he's also a rapper. He goes by Jay Green. And I'm like, if you can rap and you produce, then you can do this podcast in your own way. And I don't have to guide you through it. So he was like the ideal candidate of, okay, you have a story, you have a connection to the neighborhood, and you technologically know how to do this. So I think he was the most like personal storyteller that we featured. And that was really fun to have that connection.
This is Matt. I'm on the bus now. I just want to talk briefly about the interviews that I've been doing so far. Been trying to get different age ranges, different genders, things like that, you know, just to kind of get everyone's perspective so we don't, you know, say it's biased or anything like that.
What can podcasts like this and the kind of things that we've heard, how can they shape or play a role in shaping the future of the Morningside community and neighborhoods like it?
I think the biggest thing that I've learned is not to overemphasize the importance of media in that role. So I think the connections and the resources are a good step, but it really is in the hands of the community so they can direct the things that they want and get closer to the things that they need through storytelling. And I think that has to be the goal. That was the measure of success for me, is do you feel heard, and do you feel like the right people can potentially hear this and help you out?
How about you?
I think it's a way to transfer our stories. So to say we all get older, you know, you want to detail your stories throughout your life, and this is what podcasting does. So your grandchildren can be like, hey, I remember you were on this podcast. You had this podcast 20 years ago. Here it is. This is what I was going through at that time. So that's kind of how I look at podcasting. It's just, it's like autobiography through audio. Yeah, so
and there it is.
That's how I look at it.
So Morningside 48224, thumbs up, everybody.
Yeah, double thumbs up, legs up, hands up,
everything up.
All right. JG, Jonathan Galloway, Morningside podcaster, founder of Audio Wave Network, and Imani Mixon, who's Morningside 48224's podcast producer and trainer. Thanks for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Peace.
Thank you. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, Bella Isaacs, Razi Jaffrey, and Katie Raymond. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Stay safe in the snow, and thank you for listening.